Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation or firing of Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and speak with the former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb, the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We'll discuss how one of the most qualified Secretaries of Defense in decades fell out of favor with the increasingly insular and amateurish national security team in the White House, and whether Hagel was thrown under the bus because of the White House's strategic incoherence in Middle East policy as the U.S. military gets more involved in the wars in Syria and Iraq. Then we'll try to anticipate the local reaction in St. Louis, Missouri, to the verdict in the shooting death of the unarmed teenager Michael Brown, who was shot 6 times by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and African American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis, Missouri, joins us to discuss the likely decision by the grand jury of 9 whites and 3 blacks not to indict Officer Wilson and the mood in the racially divided city and suburbs of St. Louis after months of often violent demonstrations against the largely white police force in the predominantly black community of Ferguson, which has a history of police brutality and harassment of African Americans. Then we'll get an analysis of the possible verdicts against Officer Wilson and whether there is an appearance of justice or whether justice is being served in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Kenneth Nunn, a professor of law and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida, joins us to discuss the anticipated verdict in the context of the history of police shooting of African Americans and the verdict in the killing of the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin that exonerated a vigilante based on the controversial Stand Your Ground law in Florida. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he served as an assistant secretary of defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again.
And what's your understanding of why Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel was either he resigned or was fired? There seems to be some doubt as to whether this was a resignation, a voluntary resignation, or a forced one, if you will.
Well, I think it was mutual because I think Secretary Hagel recognized that even though he was Secretary of Defense, he did not have the same power that a lot of his predecessors have because the White House took over more and more of the decision-making role. The other is, I think the administration was looking to make a change to show that they're reflect the changes in their policy toward the Middle East.
Well, there's been a lot of criticism, though, that their policy towards the Middle East is incoherent and that the White House or the national security team lacks adult supervision now that Panetta and Bob Gates have gone. And if Chuck Hagel was one of those adults, what does that say?
Well, I don't think it bodes well for the administration, for the Pentagon, or for the country, because I've looked at the 23 people preceded Chuck as Secretary of Defense. Nobody brought more to the table than he did. A wounded combat veteran, political experience as a two-term senator, you know, dealing with foreign relations, and he was a manager both in the public sector and in the private sector. People forget he was number two at VA in the Reagan administration, and he was a successful manager of a cell phone business.
So what's the problem there? I've heard from David Rothkopf and Steve Clements and others that the national security team at the White House is dysfunctional, if not amateurish.
Well, I think they're trying to do too much, and I think that's part of the problem. And it's not surprising that as an administration goes on, the more and more, you know, people try and get power, and if they're close to the president. I think they were also really upset at the way people like the so-called team of rivals, you know, handled issues where when they disagreed with the president, it made its way into the, you know, into the media and people knew. And then, of course, you know, you had the, you know, after they left office being very critical of the president. Something that Hagel won't do. I can guarantee you he's not going to write a tell-all book like Gates or Panetta.
Well, but the team of rivals, of course, is in effect the president's mistake. He was the one who came up with that idea based upon President Lincoln's cabinet, and that has allowed a lot of dissent. But now it seems he's gone in the opposite direction. He's overcompensated. He's surrounded by yes men.
Well, I think that's the problem. You try and get the, you know, the right strike the right balance. And, you know, the team of rivals is a lot different now than when Lincoln was president, because what happens is you want your people in those agencies because the agency is going to have its own agenda, and you want someone who supports your agenda, not the agency's agenda. And if you take a look, you know, for example, at Secretary Gates, he didn't support going after, you know, bin Laden, resisted the, you know, the budget cuts that the president was trying to accomplish.
And Libya,
early on,
too,
when the military did not like, you know, the policy toward Afghanistan, by firing General McKiernan and putting in, you know, General McChrystal.
Right, and Gates was against Libya as well, the intervention there.
That's right.
So, but that's one of the criticisms one hears, is that the liberal interventionists are taking over in the White House and easing out the realists like Chuck Hagel.
Well, of course, that, you know, basically I think that is a concern, because if you have, you know, the so-called liberal interventionist and you don't have a realist point of view, the real issue is the extent to which people can disagree with the president but then still carry out his policies and not leak to the media.
So how much is Chuck Hagel being thrown under the bus here because of criticisms over the foreign policy, you know, swings, the failure to intervene early in Syria, and now the mess that's created, and the fact that we're bombing the Islamic State in Syria, which only helps Assad, but in Iraq, we're bombing them, which helps Iran, in effect. And there doesn't seem to be any coherence here.
Well, I think, again, the real criticism was that they didn't respond quickly enough to ISIL. You may remember the president blamed the intelligence, community, and I think this is one way to show that they're making changes so this won't happen again. I don't think it's as much a reflection of how the policy is now being carried out, because I think it is a pretty realistic policy that they're doing. But I think it was more that here's someone we could, you know, we can send this message. The other is, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think Secretary Hagel was frustrated that, you know, that he wasn't doing what a lot of other secretaries had done. And then finally, I think we shouldn't overlook the fact that his confirmation hearing really undermined his credibility and his ability to speak forcefully.
Because he just simply didn't perform it well.
And what he didn't perform it well, plus people took a lot of cheap shots at him, you know, I mean, in terms of positions he had taken on nuclear weapons, positions he had taken, the fact that he, you know, gave a lecture and the professor was an Iranian American. I mean, they made all kinds of insinuations that were just horrible.
Well, welcome to the Obama haters, though. I mean, isn't that what's going on in Washington?
Well, there's no doubt about it. And the other thing is, even when he tried to do things, you know, for example, tried to rein in the, you know, the burgeoning cost of military compensation, the Congress wouldn't go along with him. And he also inherited a defense program that didn't take into account sequestration. His predecessors kept pretending it wasn't going to happen.
So, in effect, choosing a Republican didn't buy Obama anything.
No, it didn't, because the Republicans had disowned many of the heart because he turned against the war in Iraq. And again, what is really incredible when you stop and think about it, he managed John McCain's campaign in 2000. And then brokered the arrangement between McCain and President Bush. But yet when he got up and testified to get at Obama, they were using him as a foil.
So he was an inconvenient truth teller, I take it.
No doubt about it, because he's one of the first Republicans to break with the way in which the Iraq war was being run.
So, in effect, this was a real loss, at least to your mind, Lawrence.
I think so. I mean, I've known all the secretaries of defense going back to McNamara, and he brings more to the table than any of the others. All of them brought, you know, specific skills, but he brought the whole range.
And who's he likely to be succeeded by, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I think it's going to be tough, because whoever comes in, you'll only be there, you know, a little over a year. You've got to go through a horrible, tough confirmation hearing. You won't be able to bring in your own people. A lot of the issues have already been decided. You know, for example, the budget is already be ready to be sent up for, you know, fiscal 16, and then so you work on budget for 2017, but you don't even know who's going to be president.
So what about Michel Flournoy that's being floated?
I've seen Michelle's name. I've seen Jack Reed, the Senator Reed. I've seen, you know, Adam Smith. If I were picking a candidate, I would pick Carl Levin, who is, you know, chairman of Senate Armed Services Committee, not going to run again. And, you know, he could hit the ground running.
Yeah, but isn't there a Republican governor in Michigan?
No, he didn't run. They've already had the elections been decided.
Oh, I see. So he's retiring in January.
He's retiring, yeah, and he's still working on the issue. So I think he would be, you know, an excellent choice. And again, given his experience and his age, I don't think he's looking to serve too many more times.
Right. Well, that's a good thought. What would happen with Jack Reed?
Reed would have to give up his Senate seat, and the Democrats do have a chance of taking back the Senate in 2016. Adam Smith is the ranking member on House Armed Services Committee, but the Democrats probably are not going to get control of the House in his lifetime, so he would be, you know, a natural. Michel Flournoy is qualified. The question is, if she takes it now, can she then get the job if Hillary wins?
So back to the strategy and or the lack thereof that appears to be at the heart of the problems. When you mentioned earlier, Lawrence Korb, that the president blamed ISIS or his lack of the surprise of ISIS, particularly taking Mosul, on the intelligence community, my understanding is that he wasn't properly briefed on it, that they really did miss the ball.
Well, they did. And, you know, I think obviously if you were asking me to get rid of somebody, I might have relieved, General Clapper. But again, I think this came as a, you know, combination of things, probably Secretary Hagel being unhappy and they're being unhappy with the way things are going. So it was a combination of two things, because he went with a lot of grace. I mean, if you looked at that, ceremony today, it was extremely well handled. Much different than when Bush threw Rumsfeld under the bus.
So what's your sense then of the politics behind the current foreign policy surrounding what you could call Iraq 3, the third intervention in Iraq? My understanding is that the Republicans don't want to be reminded that this was Bush and Cheney's disaster that's still with us, and that the Democrats don't want to be one blamed for the fact that they weren't able to stick it out and build up the Iraqis, even though the Iraqis basically booted them out because they wouldn't immunize contractors because of what happened with Blackwater. But it seems to me that what governs so much of what's going on now on the Democratic side is that President Obama doesn't want to be the president who lost Iraq, even though you could argue that Iraq is already lost. And that's probably also applies to Hillary Clinton if she runs. You know, she doesn't want to be a part of the administration that lost Iraq. So are we just sort of going through the motions of propping up a foreign policy that is more political than strategic?
Well, I think there is a strategic dimension to it. I think the president is correct that eventually the Iraqis are going to have to determine their own future, and he can provide the wherewithal for them to do it. I mean, he did get, Maliki to step aside. You've got a new government. Is it perfect? No, but it's more inclusive than Maliki's was. He has agreed to put, 5,000 troops on the ground, but nobody, Republicans or, Democrats, want to put combat formations there. Unfortunately, we use the term boots on the ground. I mean, what we should be saying is combat units, on the ground.
So is it a question then of Chuck Hagel not sort of doing what Kerry's doing, which is being high profile out there, making headlines? Would that have saved his job?
I think it might have, but I think given, and you may remember when after his confirmation hearing got so contentious, he basically said, well, I'm not a policymaker, I'm an implementer.
Right.
So obviously, given his low profile, it becomes somewhat easier, to get him to leave than, Secretary Kerry, who is obviously, going to set the world's record for trying to deal with so many crises at once.
The Iranian situation, obviously, with P5+1 in Iran, that's going to go on till the end of June, from what I understand.
Yeah, that will. You still got, trying to get something in the Middle East peace process. You had Kerry working on the new, you know, agreement with the Afghan government, dealing with, you know, the Russian foreign minister on Ukraine, trying to go into Geneva to try and get, you know, some sort of negotiated solution in Syria. You know, he's been involved in all of these.
So for the good of this administration and the good of the nation, it would seem that you need, you know, another Chuck Hagel. I mean, you know, you don't want any more of this amateurism and this sort of small circle of comity and agreement. You know, this, as we said earlier, or, you know, you start out with a team of rivals and you end up with a team of yes men. So,
well, that's true. You need to strike a balance. You know, when I worked in the Pentagon, Secretary Weinberger had strong feelings about issues, for example, like Lebanon. But he would never leak to the press or go public, you know, criticize the president's policy. And that's what you need. You want people with a strong, you know, viewpoint, but then go in and get the bureaucracy to do what you want. And this was not the case, for example, with Secretary Gates when Obama kept looking for alternatives to, if you will, the McChrystal Petraeus plan, and Gates didn't give him one.
Right. Well, that turned out that Biden was the one that sort of fought that one, or at least fought it to a draw, right?
Well, they did. And again, the president should hear all viewpoints, but, you know, I mean, you know, he has got to end up, you know, making the decision. Then you would hope that it's on the basis of good information. It doesn't mean that the Secretary of Defense or the Pentagon is always right, but you need to take their viewpoint into consideration.
But does that mean that the fault is with the president himself? He just doesn't, having started out with people like General Jones, who he didn't get on with at all, and who some argue was even disrespectful, has he simply, you know, gotten weary with this job and wants to sort of have peace and harmony for the last 2 years?
No, I think what he wants is he wants to show that he is in charge and, you know, that he wants to, you know, have a forceful policy that reflects on him rather than, you know, to have any more bureaucratic infighting.
So that would then indicate that he's going to have a more forceful and he's going to have more skin in the game in foreign policy?
I think so, because, again, other than immigration, most of the domestic issues, the hands are going to be tied by the Republicans in Congress. He does have that leeway in foreign policy. I mean, you talk about, well, we're trying to get a new authorization for the use of military force. Well, basically, they haven't got one, but we're still fighting.
Right, right. And now Rand Paul wants to declare war on the Islamic State.
Right, yeah. So really when it comes to foreign policy, very tough. I mean, if he were to get some sort of agreement with Iran, the Congress could moan and groan, but there's not much they can do about it.
Well, Lawrence Korb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985, and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back trying to anticipate the local reaction in St. Louis, Missouri, to the expected verdict in the shooting death of the unarmed teenager Michael Brown. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Garrett Duncan, who's a professor of education and African American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Duncan.
Thank you for having me.
And Garrett, it seems as though there will be no indictment in this case. We will know in about 40 minutes from now at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. That's when the verdict will be announced. But my understanding is, first of all, they haven't had the courtesy, the prosecutor, the local prosecutor, hasn't had the courtesy of calling the family of the victim, Michael Brown, to tell them in advance what's happening. And at this point, Officer Wilson has not been told to turn himself in. So are you anticipating that there'll be no indictment?
I anticipate there will be no indictment. And I think most of the people in the St. Louis metropolitan area anticipate that as well. And not informing the parents is contrary to what prosecuting attorney McAuliffe actually said. He said he will alert them ahead of time in anticipation of their media reports or media interviews. But that's consistent with what has been going on for the last 100 days.
So, in other words, the delay, they were expected to announce this at 5:30 local time, and they're not going to announce
right.
until 8 p.m. local time.
Right.
Was that delay designed to get the National Guard to protect the building, to get the police out? Is that what they're anticipating, that the later it is, the less likely that they'll have to deal with unrest?
That's absolutely part of it, but the other part is there has been an emphasis on children, especially elementary and middle school children being at home. And at 5:30, students have after-school programs, whether, chess or basketball or football. And that those programs usually go into about 6 o'clock p.m. And so there is also that concern that they want children home. Recently, there have been reports that children have been afraid of the protesters. And so that has been an emerging narrative as well. But it's also to allow the National Guard to organize and to position themselves.
And I believe that the Ferguson schools will be closed tomorrow. Is the same true of St. Louis schools and your university?
Not my university will be open, but Ferguson Fluorescent and Normandy schools will be closed, and it's almost the boundaries between the two districts are blurred, so they will definitely be closed on Tuesday and Wednesday. But then you also have entities within the city of St. Louis, like the Urban League, that will be closed on Tuesday and Wednesday, and you have Clayton schools. The only thing that has been announced is that they are closed for evening activities tonight, but not tomorrow. And in fact, my schools, like I said, there has been a lot of what I would consider reactionary memos and communiques sent out by email. But we have school tomorrow because, I have exams, so we're not closing down school tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's the last day of classes before Thanksgiving.
Now, St. Louis has a long history of racial troubles. I was actually just reading the other day, Garrett, a book about, of all things, the Nazi occupation of Paris during World War II. And I was reading about Josephine Baker, the famous expatriate
right.
American who took Paris by storm. She ended up working with the French Resistance and with Allied intelligence as a spy. An amazing story, an amazing woman. But her childhood in St. Louis, Missouri, in the 1920s, she was burned out of her home by a KKK racist mob.
Well, this is Dred Scott country, and if you know what the history behind that, that simply means that black people have no rights that white folks have to respect. We've had what I call a euphemism, race riots. And when you think about race riots, you think people going back and forth, but that is a mischaracterization. You have situations where you had land-owning black people being run out of their homes. And this is from East St. Louis to the metropolitan St. Louis, where they had to pick their poison. Either they could die in their houses that were lit on fire, or they could run out of their homes that were on fire and be met with gunfire. And so this goes back to the late 1800s. And so, yes, you have that pattern of violence and segregation.
So in terms of where we stand today, where you have the governor having a press conference with two African-American local council officials, everybody urging calm, the parents of Michael Brown urging calm, even though, as I say, they have not even been, the prosecutor has not done them the courtesy of calling them in advance about the verdict. And my understanding is that the prosecutor, McCulloch, his father was killed
yes.
in the line of duty as a policeman. There were some questions about his impartiality from the outset. There also has been some real questions about the methods of how he's conducted this grand jury, where he hasn't given the jurors any instructions. He's just done this huge data dump of massive amounts of information, which would suggest that he's just trying to overwhelm these people rather than give them some clarity.
Right. And there has been a lack of due diligence in with respect to so many entities, especially the Michael Brown's family members. Again, as you know, I'll reiterate, they were told that they would be given advance notice so to anticipate media interviews. But the other thing is this discourse on violence. Again, when we talk about violence, most people think of it in terms of bodily injury and or death, and there have been absolutely zero deaths except for Michael Brown in the 100 days since he was killed. And most of the violence has come from the state entities. But the president, Barack Obama, Eric Holden, and the governor asking for calm on the side of the peaceful but forceful and vocal protesters. And so that's almost disingenuous, and it just plays on his narrative that the community people are the violent ones, and they haven't perpetrated any violence. They haven't perpetrated any violence at all.
So what's your sense there, living in the community, Garrett Duncan, of the extent of injury, and as we pointed out, this goes back a long time, goes back centuries for that matter. And at what point do you think the whole point of the law is justice and closure? You know, and it doesn't sound like there's going to, if this verdict, as anticipated, will be an exoneration in effect. No indictment, then, you know, there's no way in the world that the African-American community is going to be take that lying down. I'm not suggesting that they're going to riot in any way, but on the other hand, it's just how much more evidence do you need that this kid was shot six times with his hands up? I mean,
right.
He was unarmed. I mean, you know, we just had yesterday, a 14-year-old African-American kid was shot dead by a rookie cop because he had a plastic toy gun in his waistband. And it just goes on and on. And you know, I'm not African-American, but if I was, I'd be really tired of this. I'd want this pattern of behavior to end and for people to be held accountable.
But, sir, this goes on not only decades, but, it goes on centuries. It goes back to the 1700s, but to fast forward to today, Ian, when you mentioned, you know, the role of the police, but also the role of the police is to protect a certain property interest. And when you think about the county area in St. Louis. So we talk about North County, which is Ferguson. There's also South and West County. That's predominantly white and affluent populations who once lived in North County, but they left when black middle class moved in from out of St. Louis City into that county. And so part of the police, the county police has been, is to protect the interests of those who they perceive to be the most powerful, and those are those who live in West and South County. So this is not in the least remarkable that what we see is going on. And the preservation, you have people raising money for Darren Wilson, going to Cardinal games with on the back of their jersey saying, "I am Darren Wilson." You have gun sales going out of the roof. Yes, it's deer season, but there's like a 20% increase, and it's been reported that police officers have told community members that we can't protect all of y'all, so you need to arm yourselves, because if something happens to you, you only have yourself to blame. So there's also this cultural dimension to it, and it's not just legal. You know, you have the legal and you have the extra legal thing going on here.
And what evidence of violence has there been? You said that nobody's been killed since Michael Brown has been killed. There have been demonstrations.
Right.
I believe there were some stores broken into and smashed and looted. But what's the extent of the evidence? Because I was just watching CNN before I came on the air, and there was talk about, you know, Black Panthers and violence and all this stuff that the mainstream media are always pumping up that possibility, that, you know, almost like a ritual. But it doesn't sound like there's any evidence that there's any organized. The National Guard and the police may be organized, but it doesn't feel like the protesters are organized to do anything particularly violent at this point.
Well, for the most part, the protesters are not trying to organize themselves around violence. In fact, they've been most vocal in saying that we're nonviolent because they're rejecting these representations. Now, with respect to the new Black Panther Party, I've written about them. I've grown up in the Black Panther Party environment. The original Black Panther Party actually rejects the new Black Panther Party. And so we need to understand that there's a clear-cut this difference between the two. And this is interesting. A new Black Panther Party member bought a weapon and was actually arrested for having a weapon. But then I told you all these white men have been buying weapons, and I've yet to hear of any single white person being arrested for having a weapon. And maybe it's because of the political affiliation for being with the new Black Panther Party or whatnot. But so you have these multiple tensions. And again, the concern is that the violence is going to be perpetrated on the protesters, and you will have some perpetrators respond. And you did mention the looting, and that looting is mixed. So we have people here in the local area who participated, but you've had so many people coming from the outside. I mean, as far away from California, Texas, and New York, and we know this because when they're arrested, they have to give their IDs, and they actually drove in to take advantage of this situation. So that's a complicated situation. It's not simply Ferguson residents doing damage in their own communities.
Yeah, well, at the press conference for Governor Nixon that was just on an hour or so ago, a so-called journalist from the Revolutionary Communist Party gate crashed and asked the only question. There you have it. So what's your sense then of where things are likely to, what do you anticipate in 25 minutes from now? I mean, obviously we're speculating here, but My sense is that the likely decision of the grand jury of 9 whites and 3 blacks is not to indict Officer Wilson.
And I concur with you on that. And I also anticipate 2 other things. I anticipate that there will be vociferous protesting, but non-physical violence, because when we talk about violence, there tends to be a collapsing of all kind of violence, you know, whether it is physical, property, or psychological violence. There will be protesting. And then my concern is that you may have errant police officers responding in a way that is disproportional to the kind of protesting. In other words, responding with violence. And then that might beget violence. And that's not only my concern, but that's been the concern of a lot of people that I've been speaking with and talking with throughout the community.
Well, in terms of Officer Wilson, who apparently has just recently gotten married for the second time, he's apparently been approached by every news anchor from the mainstream, you know, from the big networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN. And what are the? I mean, McCulloch, prosecutor, as I mentioned, has his family history. His father was a policeman who was killed, and he's apparently fairly friendly to the police, which is not entirely surprising.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. Well, you know better than I do. I'm not there, what are they going to be saying tomorrow, assuming this guy is the officer is let off for firing 6 shots at an unarmed African-American kid, a teenager, who is apparently holding up his hands when he's getting shot? Now, they did apparently have a scuffle prior to that, but still, how can this behavior be justified under the color of police authority?
Will you repeat that, sir?
Well, I'm saying what do you anticipate the justification will be for not indicting this police officer in something that seems so obvious, where an unarmed teenager was shot 6 times, facing the policeman with his hands up? That's you know. So, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I have a police officer at my door.
Oh, you do? Oh.
Yes. Sir, are you you have a concern about something?
Yeah, your dog was going off. We had a couple of burglars in the area, and I heard your dog in the back alley.
So okay. No, we're good. I'm actually on the phone in the interview.
Okay,
okay, we're good.
You,
no problem.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Well, that sounds like the police doing their job, protect and serve. Right,
right, right, right.
Well, here we are.
I was trying to tell him to be quiet. I'm on the phone, but
the policeman was knocking your door because there was a dog barking and there's a robbery in the neighborhood. That what he said? That's what I heard
exactly
him say.
Exactly. He said there have been burglars, and I've actually have been burglarized here.
Right. Well, so you're getting the good side of the police, right?
Well, let me tell you something about this. This is serendipitous. Because several months ago, there had been reports, the disproportionality of the police department in terms of race and, you know, the number of black police officers. Mm-hmm. In my city, in my little county area, which is really small, we actually have a 50-50 black-white police representation. And the police in our area act completely different from the way they do in Clayton or the way they do in Normandy.
And Ferguson.
And so I think that's really interesting.
And Ferguson, I take it. Because
and Ferguson, absolutely.
Because yeah. That was
where they're all disproportionate. Ours is 50-50.
Right, but Ferguson had, 50 white officers and, 3
absolutely.
Non-white? Yeah.
Absolutely. Ours is different, and you know, I see them all the time, and I know most of the police officers out here, but I do get stopped. don't let me get it wrong.
Right.
Now, you ask a question, and I got distracted. I'm going to ask you to ask me
I just wanted to get a final statement from you, which is, how do you anticipate the prosecutor and the police and those who support Officer Wilson, how are they going to justify the killing of this unarmed black teenager who had his hands up and who was shot six times?
The only way they could justify it is by disclosing all of the evidence. Now, McCullough said that he would do that, but you had a judge at the last minute said, no, that's not going to happen. We're not going to disclose the evidence. And so the only way you could do that is through both the disclosure of the evidence and also interviews with the grand jurists, you know, the folks who served on a grand jury. And that's the only way there might be an explanation. But I have to tell you, Ian, any justification for an exoneration will fall short. We out here, the pulse of the community is that there needs to be an open trial with complete transparency.
Well, Garrett Duncan, I thank you very much for joining us here this evening.
And thank you, and I apologize for the interruption.
No. I thought that was an interesting sidebar, indicating again that there is a good side to the police. They do protect and serve.
There you go.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the history of police shootings of African Americans. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Nunn.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And obviously, we're anticipating the verdict from the grand jury what is the fate of Officer Darren Wilson, who shot the unarmed teenager Michael Brown six times. The verdict has been delayed. The National Guard has been surrounding the county courthouse where the grand jury sat. The families have not been informed of the victim, Michael Brown's family, which seems incredibly discourteous. But in general, the delays indicate, and as far as I know, according to the latest reports, is that Officer Wilson has not been asked to turn himself in. So do you think it's reasonable to expect there will be no indictment?
Well, it's beginning to look that way. I think the fact that there has been no notification of the family about whether charges would be brought or not, and the fact that, as far as we know, the officer is still walking around free at this point. So it would seem to me that at the very least, they're not preparing to take him into custody tonight.
And in terms of the charges, the possible charges against him, they range from first-degree murder all the way down to involuntary manslaughter.
That's right. They could charge him with first-degree murder. They could And I hope you're hearing me, because I'm getting a fair amount of feedback here. I'm sorry, Ian.
No, we can. You sound good, actually.
Oh, okay, great. There's a first-degree murder charge, of course, would suggest that there was a premeditated killing. You could also have a second-degree murder charge, which would be the case if the jury were to find that it was an intentional killing, but there was no premeditation. And that would probably be the case if we thought that this happened so fast, you know, that there was so much anger that was involved, that this was the reason why the shooting took place. So these kinds of killings that take place in anger, hot anger, would be a second-degree killing, unless, of course, it would be reduced by a jury to a voluntary manslaughter charge. And so those would be the lesser charges, would be manslaughter charges. And you could get to manslaughter either because the jury believes that the shooting took place in a heat of passion. So the heat of passion was such that it would excuse, or partially excuse at least, the killing in the mind of the jury. If the passion was, you know, the person was angry, they were upset, but it wasn't to such a degree that they lost their ability to control their behavior, then that would be second-degree murder. But if it was, you know, an extreme degree of anger, then that could reduce the charge to manslaughter. Now, you could also get the manslaughter if there was a killing that was viewed as accidental, more or less, by the jury. That is, one that was reckless or negligent, and that could result in a manslaughter charge as well. So there are lots of different avenues to come back with some form of criminal charge in this case.
But are there distinctions in the law between a policeman killing somebody and an ordinary civilian killing somebody?
Well, yes and no. There are no differences insofar as whether or not the elements of homicide are present or not, as we just discussed. What does make a difference is whether or not there is an excuse that an officer can have that a ordinary person couldn't have, because they were not trying to effectuate some law enforcement objective, such as arrest someone. So if the officer was engaged in the performance of his duties and he was using the degree of force that was necessary for him to perform his duties, and a killing took place in the course of that, then that would not be a homicide. That would be a homicide. It would not be a crime. It would be justifiable homicide.
So, and at this point, of course, we don't know, except we're speculating, that the atmospherics would indicate that there'll be no indictment. And given that, that raises the question or the specter of lots of police shootings of African Americans. The most visible was in your neighborhood, the Trayvon Martin shooting by a vigilante who was exonerated on the grounds of this controversial law down in Florida, Stand Your Ground. But again, the victim was an unarmed teenager.
Well, that's right, and it's interesting that you talk about that case in connection with police shootings, because in a lot of ways that case kind of tracked the way that these police shooting cases go, where you have someone who's known to the police that they have a relationship with, that they're apparently reluctant to charge in the first place or arrest in the first place, and that it's very difficult for the prosecutor to be able to persuade a jury that this person should be held responsible for the killing, because the person is presented to the jury and perhaps to the public at large as being in the nature of a hero who is one of our protectors, that sort of thing. And so I think that the same kind of dynamics that you would have in a police shooting case played out in that Trayvon Martin case. But you know, there are, unfortunately, a substantial number of shootings of young African-American unarmed males by the police. You know, we don't have any figures, at least we don't have very good figures about how often that happens, but we do have figures that would suggest that African-Americans are shot by the police, whether armed or unarmed, but they're shot by the police about 20 times more often than other Well, actually, I should say then whites are shot by the police. I was going to say other races, but I think the figures that I have are involving blacks and whites. So there's a number of these cases that occur. Certainly, there are many, infamous cases that we can be aware of that fit this category. I believe there was someone recently shot out in your area, Los Angeles, by the police, a young black male for whom there has not been a great deal of publicity. But unfortunately, these things do occur with some degree of frightening frequency.
And of course, there was, I think, just yesterday, a 14-year-old African-American boy was shot because he had a replica of a plastic toy pistol in his waistband.
Right.
So, again,
and
I'm speaking...
A young man was shot in Ohio where he was examining a BB gun. There was someone who was shot in the stairwell in New York recently, and that goes without speaking about some of the more infamous cases like Deshaun Bell case at New York where the gentleman was shot multiple times by the police. So there are a couple cases in Miami where people were shot multiple times by the police, no prosecutions in those cases as well. But basically with this case, what I'm concerned about is the fact that although there was sufficient evidence for charges to have been brought from the very outset, that we have a case where the prosecution declined to bring charges and instead took the case to the grand jury. And once the case got to the grand jury, we have a situation where the prosecutor did not ask the grand jury to return any particular charges or not. And we have to understand that prosecutors as a whole have a tremendous sway over the grand jury. And the way that we talk about this in the legal field is the common saying is, well, a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. It's they have that much sway and that much power over the grand jury. So the fact that this case has taken this long, that there were no charges at the outset and that there have been no charges from the grand jury and the grand jury has met as long as it has, all of those suggest to me that it would be very unlikely that there would be charges against Officer Darren Wilson sure. At the conclusion of this case.
Which will happen, it's already, the case is already concluded, but the verdict will be heard in about 10 minutes. What you just explained to the audience, Kenneth, would indicate to me that in a way you can make the case that the fix was in here. This is apparently what this prosecutor has done, rather than guide the jury, instruct the grand jury, basically just did a data dump and just overwhelmed them with all this data.
I'm not sure I'd use the term the fix was in, but I would say that the prosecutor was probably searching for what we call a no bill, where the grand jury comes back with no indictment. Because if they wanted that, see, you have to understand, the prosecutor doesn't have to even present any information that is exculpatory to a grand jury. Since the grand jury is only looking for probable cause, which is some probability that the officer committed the crime, all they have to show is evidence that shows probable cause, which is evidence of what we would call guilt if it were a trial. So if the officer really, if the prosecutor really wanted an indictment, he just would have gotten the witnesses that said the young man's hands were up and he turned around and the officer shot him, presented just those witnesses to the grand jury, and there would have been an indictment and that would have been it. So, yes, the fact that this was presented in a different way is evidence, in my mind, that the officer, not the officer, I keep saying the officer, but the prosecutor was looking for no indictment in this case.
Before you say to me
that's unfair, well, that's the way grand jury indictments usually proceed in the ordinary case, is that you only have the evidence of guilt that's being presented.
Right. That's, by and large, the function of the grand jury is to indict, not to act as a defense lawyer. I mean, I did go too far by saying the fix was in, but it does seem that the prosecutors bent over backwards to make sure that by not instructing the jury, by not from day one not indicting based upon the evidence available from all the eyewitnesses, indicates to me that this is at the very least has been handled with kid gloves.
Well, absolutely, and I think that's the problem with having with the way that police shootings are investigated and prosecuted or not prosecuted in our country today, whether we're talking about at the local level, at the statewide level, or at the federal level, that there is too much of a cozy relationship between prosecutors who rely on police officers to make cases, the bulk of their cases, and who engage in a working relationship with individual officers and with entire departments. They are not the right people to look at these cases objectively and make a decision whether or not the law was violated and whether or not someone will stand to answer for the violation of that law. It is absolutely, in my mind, incredible that in this case where you have a prosecutor who not only had the usual kind of close relationship with the police department that the prosecutor in Ferguson had, but who also was the son of a police officer who was shot in the line of duty. I mean, I just think that these are the kinds of facts that we need to reevaluate how these cases are prosecuted. Perhaps there's a way to ensure that we have an independent prosecutor who looks at these cases, or that we make sure that the prosecutor who handles the case comes in from outside of the jurisdiction at the very least.
And if, as is likely, that Officer Wilson won't be indicted, the next step would be a civil case involving the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and that's a very high bar, isn't it? And we've just got a few seconds left. Would you agree?
Well, it's a high bar with the exception that they're both civil and criminal cases that could be brought. Okay,
right.
There's a Section 242 of the U.S. Code which looks at the deprivation of rights under color of law, and then there are also there's also a chapter that looks at when a person engages in federally protected activities is what they call it. But things like walking on the street would be a federally protected activity.
Mm-hmm.
So those cases are felonies, and you can, in fact, wind up with a life imprisonment in the case of bodily injury or death penalty in the case of the death, and as was the case in this case. But you're right, there's a high bar. You have to show that there was a specific intent to deprive the person of their right and to kill them in the case here. So you have to show that. So in essence, that would be the same barrier that we would have to a first-degree murder prosecution where you have to show that
sure.
specific intent.
Well, Kenneth, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to speak with you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Nunn, who is a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll